Okay, well, thank you all for being here. As I said in my first class, maybe a lot of your duplicates. I'm up here not so much because I enjoy public speaking, but because I enjoy the opportunity to once again study the subject of photography and enjoy, and I knew that by agreeing to give this talk, I would have to study it some more and learn more from it myself. So, talking about composition craftsmanship, careful curation of the elements in your photo is key to creating a pleasing composition. A photographer often has limited control over his subject matter, but we will look at common compositional techniques to help you maximize the artistic value of your photograph. So, as is a common thread through any of the workshops that you hear today, whether it be writing or whether it be music or whether it be art or photography is no different. Design, we already heard a lot about being intentional in the elements of your craft. You need to be intentional with what you include, with what you exclude. Oftentimes, less is more. And it's just fascinating how much the principles are still the same, even in photography. So, let's consider, let's consider a painting. This is Home in the Woods by Cole Thomas, and not so much that it's an amazing painting. I mean, it is an amazing painting, but I just simply wanted to consider it for a little bit, because as a painter considers what goes on his canvas and what does not, that same intentionality is difficult to achieve as a photographer, but if you want artistic work, then it's worth thinking about. An artist does not put something on his canvas that he couldn't get rid of, as you do in your photo. Oftentimes, there are objects that, you know, ideally you wouldn't have there, right? But it's there, it's part of the landscape, it's part of the background. So, I'm simply speaking about art here, simply to help you consider what objects in your landscape or in your photo should you minimize, could you minimize, would help your impact of your emotion of your photo be better. I am personally a fan of Kincaid paintings, paying a special attention to his use of light, right? Light is also used in photography, right? And if you've done any photography, you understand that light is very crucial for it, but it's also can be very hard to control. For instance, if you're taking pictures outside, I do graphic design and marketing for a job, and one of the things we get to do this time of year is run around and take pictures. This past month, twice I was outside taking pictures of roofs or buildings or external things, maybe some of which you'll see later. But sunlight, especially harsh sunlight, is pretty difficult to photograph nicely. So sometimes it's worth maybe even rescheduling to say, maybe we can find a cloudy day. Two of the times I was pleasantly surprised that the day that we picked ended up being really ideal conditions for photography. So that's nice when that works that way. But paying special attention to the elements in your photo is key in getting a nice picture. So, I don't know, it's kind of tough to judge with a subject like this how much content I will need. This morning I felt like I was a little low on the content, and maybe that'll be the same today, right now, or maybe I'll have too much, I don't know. But we will kind of start with a little broader concepts of rules of composition, and then maybe we'll kind of narrow down as we move along. So, let's think about some rules of composition. These have already been mentioned if you were in the design classes. Some of them are fairly common, and what was true there is also true here. So, rule of thirds, thinking about the dividing up your photo into three, nine segments, but into thirds either way, horizontally and vertically, and then aligning objects according to that. The balance in your photo, we'll talk a little bit about leading lines, which is simply what is your photo doing, calling whoever's looking at your photo to where does it direct their eyes, point of view, and cropping, and then we'll have maybe a couple more. And this is by no means a comprehensive list. First of all, let's talk about rule of thirds a little bit. So, as we said, divide your line into, and I don't know how well you can see it, you should be able to see it a little bit. Divide your photo, we have lines running through the image. I'm sure you're familiar with this concept. And then align the objects, key objects in your photo along that. Simply adds interest to your photo. It's fascinating how if you stop and think about, if you see a well-done photo, even if you haven't analyzed why it catches your attention, if you stop and analyze it, oftentimes it's following a rule of some sort, whether it's the rule of thirds or whether it's balance or symmetry or whatever it might be. So dividing the photo in three equal sections, vertically and horizontal, then we align the key objects to the intersections and the lines. Here's another example of if you're going to take simply any photo, and you're going to try to use the rule of thirds to decide how to crop it or how to frame it, you would align the key elements, being most importantly the sun, but also the basketball hoop also being a key element in the photo. Align them to the rule of thirds, and some of this is done in post whenever you crop it. Give yourself a little bit extra room, but as you're as you learn to do that, you will also naturally frame the image whenever you take it in that way. So it's worth paying attention to. It's something that as you practice, you'll become better and better at. And you're probably a good chance you naturally kind of do it, even if you don't realize that's what you're doing. If you were to also kind of the average of the tree line, right, is somewhat along the rule of thirds line as well. Balance in your imagery, dividing the quadrants of dividing an image into quadrants, and then having them complement each other. And here, this picture, obviously, we kind of have equal things happening. They don't always have to be equal, but if you have kind of a weight in one quadrant, you also would have a weight in the opposite quadrant. And that would bring some balance to the image. So the various quadrants of the image complement each other in aesthetically pleasing ways. Like I said, it doesn't necessarily have to be a mirror image. Obviously, that is, a mirror image is obviously balanced. Leading lines. Thinking a little bit about the lines that are in your image that kind of frame your image. So here we kind of have the rows kind of leading into, what you can see of the rows, leading into the main product, the focal point of your image. And then even here we have some lines that are keeping your eye from going at the top, bringing focus more to this. And I'm not saying this is an amazing example of this. This was a product shot that I took 2 weeks ago. But it's simply a way, as you frame your image, pay attention to it. And maybe I could have moved a little bit. There's some other variations to it. Maybe I could have moved a little bit and brought these to be more consistent. But pay attention to what the lines in your image are doing. Here's an image that I took in Old Town Winchester a couple years ago. But here again, this being kind of the main focal point, we have the branches kind of bringing you in, kind of pointing you towards the main focal point of the steeple of the building. And here again, if you pay attention to the rule of thirds, this is kind of along, probably along approximately the third line. This is maybe a little bit towards the center, but you kind of get the idea. Oftentimes, it's not only one rule that you're bringing into play. Oftentimes, it's multiple rules at the same time. So that's leading lines. Pay attention to your point of view. This is as you're taking pictures. Move around, up, down, side to side, closer, further away, and think about, as you're doing this, think about what you want the what you're going to be using the picture for. So here's what, this is what I was taking a picture of. Obviously, it's some cattle equipment, sheep equipment. And most of the time I was taking a picture from the front of it, right? And we were getting a couple different perspectives with the drone simply to showcase the equipment and what it's used for. But at the same time, the person that I was doing it for is a small farmette products vendor, and he has a catalog that we are getting ready to reprint, and he said, while you're here, get me a cover photo for your catalog. So that the cover photo for a catalog obviously means something different. We're not only selling sheep equipment, right? While it's fine to have the sheep equipment on the catalog cover, that's not what we only want to do. So I moved around to the side, and we end up with a side perspective. Now, obviously, we don't want to include him in the edit, but if we edit it a little bit, and ideally, if we could have gotten rid of this, maybe I'll get rid of this before the final print version, get rid of the well. But soon we have a catalog cover, right? So think about what you're going to be using the image for, and then pay attention to moving around up, down, to the side, and getting a perspective that actually fits your the use case. So I've been noticing this, especially considering some drone photography. I've, like I said, been able to do some buildings, exteriors, and this one was not one of the ones recently. But the fun thing about drones, whenever you're doing photography, especially with buildings, is that you can move around a lot, quite a lot. And but then it's also very possible to use trees and foliage to very nicely frame the building. So we're not covering up the building, but we're even minimizing the fact that there's a driveway here. We're minimizing the fact that there's a walkway, maybe some dead grass over here. And we're drawing all the attention to the building, because that's who we were doing the photography for. We're doing the photography for the builder who made this building. So move around, change your perspective. Here, if I were to ask you, what do you think this person, why did I take this picture? What was I doing? Well, good chance, I cropped the roof off. It's probably not a roof picture, right? So it's probably either the back of the house or maybe the deck, right? But if we go ahead and move around a little bit here, very quickly, we're covering up everything except for we're drawing all our focus here to the deck, right? Clearly, we still have the side of the house, but we're using other elements in the foreground to draw all the attention to where we want it to draw to. No one's going to probably even, if I showed you this picture, you probably wouldn't even notice that there were trees in the foreground, right? But you would naturally be drawn to the deck, and maybe the homeowner was running off, but we probably should have uncluttered the deck a little bit to make it even better. Now here's one that I probably didn't do perfectly, but drawing the focus to the building here, we do have, it's covered up a lot by the trees, but I wanted to bring in a little bit of foreground to add some depth, but also to bring the focus to the building, and I probably added too much. That's what my brother immediately pointed out. You added too much, which is true, but I don't remember. I know it kind of sloped off, and I don't remember what else was here, and I think there was a reason that I added that much of the foreground to it. But pay attention, move around, and you always make mistakes, or you often make mistakes, and it's worth learning from. You can still take it and learn from what you have. Here again, we have a picture of a house, nicely framed by the foliage around it. So, simply saying, move around, change your perspective, and like I said, with a drone, that becomes very obvious because you have to decide, okay, where am I going to take this picture from, right? You don't fly a drone just to take a picture from the ground. So you're clearly already trying to decide where to take the picture from. Sometimes you have obstacles. But it was kind of what made this point clear to me was the fact that I've been doing some more of this recently and been reminded that we can use the foreground elements or foliage to nicely frame the shot and bring attention to exactly what we want to bring attention to. Let's talk a little about cropping your photo. Oftentimes, it's worth giving yourself a little extra breathing room whenever you frame the photo, because you don't know exactly, this is just a stock image, you don't know exactly how you're going to use it. But also pay attention whenever you crop the photo to the emotion that you want to give to the photo. Matt illustrated, kind of took this one from me this morning, right? You want to usually give the subject to move into, bring the action in. Or if you have someone who's looking a specific direction, usually they look towards the open area of the content. Or you may want to add tension, depending on what you're doing. This is obviously a rare case, but you may want to add tension and have them leaping off, right? But obviously you have to understand, why am I taking this picture? What is the emotion that I want to convey to the whoever's looking at this picture? What am I trying to do with it? Do I want the action coming in? Usually that's the case, but there may be times for exception. Let's look a little bit about depth. So add some visual interest by creating some depth. Add foreground and background elements to frame your subject. Even in focus and out of focus objects. We talked a little bit about depth of field this morning, which we'll talk a little bit about again. But depth being similar to point of view, in that trying to figure out, you know, what is the best place to take your photo from. So depth is kind of similar to that. But notice here, this is the same deck that I photographed earlier, but I saw that there was a tree, a little tree right here. So I framed it with my camera so that this tree kind of covers up this empty sky, because I didn't feel like the empty sky would add anything for my picture. In fact, it would just kind of detract and open up the picture to the top. So I tried to add an element here. There was a tree nicely there, which is why I thought of it. Add an element that would keep the focus being here and not distract from the focus being the deck. So simply paying attention to what your surroundings are, and probably the more you do it, the more you're immediately available or immediately aware of the surroundings and how you can use the surroundings to influence your photo. So here I didn't have anything up above to add to the image, but I added a little bit of the foreground here to add some interest to the photo, and there again to put the focus of the image still on the deck, obviously the deck being the largest thing. We can also use, introduce some blur. This was a fun little experiment that I had at the office. There was a, is anyone familiar with the tilt shift lens? Has anyone used a tilt shift lens at all? So a tilt shift lens is kind of unique because, as you can see here, they give you two axis points to kind of shift the angle of your lens. So this does a couple unique things. One is that you all know how if you stand in front of a building and take a picture of the building, right? The building continues to slope up and away, right, to a point. So if you use this tilt shift lens, you can actually correct for that in the lens itself by changing the planes. And I won't get into all of that, but the way that the lens can shift between the lenses, it's pretty fascinating. But what it also often is used for, I'm sure you've seen the pictures where they kind of make something look miniature that's not. This is taken from the top of a parking garage in Winchester, but because we have a plane that's in focus here, and the other is interrupted by some out of focus planes, it adds a very unique perspective and kind of makes things look miniature. And maybe the impact is lost a little bit on the projector. But here's another one with a similar, where we have a in-focus area here, but we have out-of-focus kind of moving away in multiple planes. Kind of gives a really miniature look. So simply being adding a blur, which you can obviously do in post, but it's a one another tool that you can use, and this is obviously a very niche case, but adding blur to bring focus to your subject, whatever you're trying to convey. So as I said, art has rules. We talked about some higher level rules that are not necessarily always to be followed, but you have to understand how to effectively use them to understand how to effectively break them if you're trying to capture the perfect photo. I think the sorry, I missed my note. I was doing some research. I was came across an article on CaptureTheAtlas.com, and they listed 25 different compositional techniques to keep in mind when taking pictures. Some of which, all of which were what I mentioned, were there, but there was many more of the what they called the perfect angles, and somewhat using the spiral, golden spiral as a reference, as well as drawing angles in your photo and drawing attention between them. And so there's many different ways of building interest into your photo, using rules to capture impactful photo. I only touched on a couple of them, so it's worth knowing. And like I said, if you notice any great photo, if you stop, take the time to analyze it, oftentimes you'll realize they were using one of these rules as a baseline for their picture. So let's talk a little bit more about capturing the perfect photo. We talked about this morning kind of understanding your equipment, knowing your equipment, but it's important to then manipulate those settings to capture the perfect photo. We'll talk a little bit more about shutter speed, depth of field, focal length, and color here, and talk about how those impact your photo. Once again, this exposure triangle. If you need to increase any of these or decrease any of these, it will affect your photo. So you're going to also need to counter it by changing one of these. If you're going to increase your aperture to a smaller amount of light, then you're going to have to allow your ISO to capture more light or lower your shutter speed. So it's important to understand, I guess, which one will help you capture the image that you're wanting to capture, and then adjust the others accordingly. So let's talk a little bit about shutter speed. So if we have slow shutter speed, and this was simply the other evening, two of my daughters were running around the table, and I thought that's a perfect instance illustration of what I was thinking about when I was thinking about this concept. Is the shutter speed is too slow because there's not a lot of light, and this is simply captured with my phone. Too slow with a lot of light that if I move fast, following her with my camera, tracking her with my camera, she will be clear. You can see her face is pretty much in focus, while she is obviously moving around, hanging on for dear life. She is clear. She still has a little bit of movement, but all the rest of the movement in the picture is horizontally, and that's because I'm tracking her with my phone. Here's a stock image that shows you the exact same thing. So maybe you want to slow down your shutter speed and track your subject and intentionally introduce blur. So this has a whole new unique way of separating the subject from the background while telling you that there is a lot of motion going on in this picture. What's probably a key area you'd see this type of photography would be sports, right? Oftentimes they're tracking the subject, whether it's a sports player or a race car or something, and the background is blurred in a direction. That's how they're capturing it. And they might add some editing, obviously, to finish the job. But a lot, you'd be surprised how much of that content you can actually capture in your camera. Here's another reason you might want to change your shutter speed. So here's a picture of a fire, which is great. But I'm going to show you three different pictures here and think a little bit about the emotion that each one is capturing. So this image is captured at 1/8,000th of a second. You can probably guess why. It's because the fire is bright, right? And we want to capture the flames nicely. So, but 1/8,000th of a second means that while it properly exposed the picture, the flames are pretty much frozen, which if you sit by a campfire, you know that the flames are not frozen. They're constantly moving, which, depending what you're portraying, this might be great. But if you slow it down a little bit, how about we slow it down and blur these a little bit? Maybe this gives us a little more of a cozy campfire scene. And this is, actually, you don't even have to slow down your shutter speed very fast. This is 1/20th of a second, and you already get some nice fluid motion to the flames, and it gives you maybe a little more of a cozy emotion to the photo. Versus if we sit there and expose it even longer yet, at 10 seconds, we get kind of this feeling of a white hot fire, right? Something that's really burning. And all that was changed in those three photos was the shutter speed. Obviously, I had to change some other settings to continue to achieve this feeling, these feelings. But understand your shutter speed and how it's going to impact your subject and impact the emotion of your shot. This was kind of the same as the one, I already showed this one in my other class, but fireworks at 1/10th of a second are really not that impressive. And as you think about fireworks, this is not what you think about. You think about a lot more light than this. This might be a little more accurate to what you're thinking about whenever you think about fireworks. And this might even be a little overdone, and yet it's showing you an artistic take of what it is like to experience some fireworks. And that was at 12 seconds. And this one is probably a little bit more in the middle at 5.7 seconds. And this is kind of the iconic picture of what you think about whenever you think about going and experiencing some fireworks. So understand your shutter speed, how it's going to impact the emotion of your photo, and then what do I want to convey? Maybe I just want maybe I want a really long exposure with lots of things going on, or maybe I just want, you know, a little bit happening. Here is at the Apple Blossom Festival. I went down just for the express purpose of being able to capture some of the motion that's constantly going on at the fair here, so you can see the rides that are constantly moving, and it gives you that emotion of all the action that's going on. That's only 1.6 seconds, but it's long enough to capture a lot of motion and a lot of happening bustle. All right, thinking about depth of field and the effect that it has on your photo. Depth of field being affected by a couple different things. No, so this was more about what we talked about this morning, but understand how aperture affects your depth of field, your distance to your subject, your focal length, and your sensor size. All of these are factors to depth of field, so that you're going to want to pay attention. Now, this photo, I took, and I cheated, because you can see, if you pay attention, we have a disc golf basket here. As you can tell, I enjoy disc golf. But we have a disc golf basket here that it is in focus, as well as the tee pad is in focus, but this area here is not in focus. Well, the reason I had to do this was because I only had one lens, because I wasn't going to carry around a bunch of lenses, but I did want, it was a nice place to play, and I did want to get a couple pictures because it was also a beautiful time of year. So I only had one lens, so I had to make do, and it was my 70 to 200 millimeter lens at f/2.8. So I took a picture, focused it here, took a picture, focused it here, and put them together. But understand the depth of field and how it's going to impact the emotion of your shot. Oftentimes you can separate your subject from the background by adding some depth of field. Add some foreground elements, add some background elements, and that will separate your subject and bring the attention to what you want to bring the attention to. The focus of this product shoot was not about the strawberries, because in reality, we took it before strawberries were even ripe, and they would have all been green. So clearly the emotion is not, the point of the image is not about the strawberries, but the point of the image is this contraption that allows you to lay down, take, and ride through the rows of produce and pick it without bending over and breaking your back while you do it. So the whole point of this image being this piece of equipment. The whole point of this image being the portrait, right? So here, once again, we use a couple different elements. Probably the biggest one that you notice is the depth of field. And as I mentioned before, I personally have a pick against, or don't care for the images that show that have too great of a depth of field where you can't tell at all what's going on, but you need at least some depth of field, right, where the elements in the background draw the attention to the foreground. So here, we also use the tree to frame the subject, right? We're kind of framing the same shape of the individual, as well as the elements in the background. The colors nicely complement her dress color. So pay attention to your elements. Also pay attention to your depth of field. If you're taking a picture of a family, you probably won't want to go to the maximum depth of field. Like I said, oftentimes the aperture, right, is what affects your depth of field. 1.4 or 2.8, depending on your lens. Having a nice wide aperture will give you a nice shallow depth of field. That can get you in trouble whenever you go to take pictures of a family, right? Because he obviously is towards the back of the arrangement. She is towards the front. And I didn't actually look to see how well they are all in focus. I do know for a fact that this was actually taken in 2.8. And if you look closer, yeah, she is a little bit out of focus, and that's why you'll probably want to, if you're doing a family or a large group, you for sure want to do a minimum of 3.5, maybe even 4.0 aperture, and then you have to adjust your distance to the subjects and distance to the background accordingly to get nice depth of field. Yes.
So this picture, especially the one just before it, I noticed you have the foreground quite blurred. Is that because you were using a zoom lens? Or did you hold something in front of it that went out of focus? Like on that one,
yeah.
Grass.
Both.
Or
I am
something long in front of it to kind of get out of the depth of field.
Both. I'm doing the same thing. Both of them, I'm laying on the ground with my lens down against the ground. Mm-hmm. So that brings in.
When I do that, I often get it looking up at them.
Looking up at them?
And
yeah. So the other thing that I don't know what your focal length is, because I'm pretty sure on both of these I'm also using my 70-200 at 200 millimeters. So I'm actually pretty far away, which disadvantage of that is it's pretty tough to keep, especially the little one's attention whenever you do that. So if you don't have someone helping you, just standing around, jumping around, making a bunch of noise or movement, it's tough to keep their attention because you are pretty far away from them. But yeah. That's worth, because if you were to do that with a shallower depth of field, yeah, you're going to get the feeling of you're looking up at them, because you are actually looking up at them with an angle. Great questions. Any other questions? Or if you have any other questions as I'm going through this, feel free to stop me.
Can you explain the relationship again between the aperture and your focal distance and your depth of field? In other words, so...
aperture, focal distance, and depth of field. So both your aperture and your focal distance is going to affect your depth of field.
In other words, the more you zoom in on a subject, the narrower your depth of field. Is that right?
Yes, ish, yes.
But also, the more open your aperture is, the narrower the depth of field.
Yes,
well.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is why if you're thinking about... yeah, if you're thinking about lenses, if you've done any photography and you have two different lenses and you're trying to go do portrait photography, if you're thinking about a lens that's going to have some nice depth of field, you're going to grab the zoom lens, right? The one that's farther away, zoomed in, versus the wide angle, right? Because the wide angle doesn't give you as much depth of field. So your focal length does affect your depth of field. If you have a zoom lens, it's going to help you. So like I said, both of these, pretty sure, are my 70 to 200 at the full 200 zoomed all the way in.
The point is, if you want a really nice bow, you need expensive.
That's not the point. It is an unfortunate. It is an unfortunate factor. In reality, yeah. The lens is probably the most important part whenever it comes to your camera equipment. So let's talk a little bit about focal length. This, like I said, I did this because I knew I was going to learn something. And I had a fun experiment the other morning whenever I went out and just tried to understand a little bit more about focal length. So something that you've probably also noticed but haven't stopped to take note of is what impact does your focal length have on your subject? So this is not necessarily a subject worthy of photographing, but it's simply my car. But here you can see that, so I have my, I went for the longest distance I could. So this is 800 millimeters. This is my 100 to 400 lens with a 2x extender on it, which I was talking about this morning, the same one that I was able to shoot the picture of the sun with. I guess since I said that, don't shoot the sun with your camera unless you have a mirrorless, because you don't want to look at the sun, but your camera can handle it, but you don't want to look with your eye. So I don't recommend taking pictures of the sun, and just want to be clear on that. But if you know what you're doing and have the equipment, it's not going to damage your camera as long as you have an aperture stop down. Anyway, so don't hurt yourself in the process of taking pictures. Usually photography is not a dangerous vocation. But anyway, so this is 800 millimeters. Sorry about the rabbit trail. This is 800 millimeters. My car is quite some distance away. You can tell a little bit that there was a little bit of a rise because I had a hard time finding a place that was flat enough for me to do this experiment. But right immediately behind, which is actually, well, you'll see later, the wall, the point of this being a large focal length kind of really flattens and compresses the image. This wall is a good, 30 yards behind my car, where you couldn't tell that from here, right? And you can also tell that the parking lot, this is early in the morning, first thing in the morning, but the parking lot is still giving you that feeling that it does on a hot summer day, right? Where you get the heat rising off affecting your vision. So at this distance, it's magnifying that already. So let's go in a little bit, go into 400 millimeters. And it's actually fairly similar, not a lot of difference, but you can already tell we're seeing a little more of the background. Go into 200 millimeters, and you can see here it's still flattened some, but this actually makes sense why you would take portraits at this 200 millimeters focal length, because it's a fairly pleasing perspective, especially as 100 millimeters. I do feel like, maybe it's because I'm looking at it at an angle, it does feel like it's a bit squashed compared to, it is a Civic, but compared to my screen. So, that's 100 millimeters, you're getting a little more natural. I don't know if the aspect ratio is quite the same. A little more natural, and then here at 50 millimeters, we continue to see even more of the background. Now you can see the fence is a good ways away, right? The car is Explorer, whatever it is behind my car, and the fence is a good ways on beyond that yet, and the buildings are even further in the background. And then we go to 30 millimeters, and now it starts to go the other way, where this is kind of getting awkward, especially if you were thinking about as a portrait photographer, you start to see some fisheye. And then lastly, we get to 16 millimeters, which is kind of the classic perspective that car manufacturers like to take, right? They kind of like to take these odd, on the brand new models, these odd kind of angles with a lot of field of view. But here at 16 millimeters, you see a lot of the background, right? You can see the neighborhood that I took it in. And all I'm simply doing by pointing that out is that Your focal length is going to have an impact on your subject. So we have a wide-angle lens for especially whenever we're inside taking pictures of kitchens, right? A 100-millimeter lens would barely take a picture of the top set of cabinets of a kitchen. But you, so you need a wide angle lens. Oftentimes that does bring in distortion, but you can pretty easily fix that. But the other thing is kind of interesting is looking at this. So you notice how much of the roof you see here, because you're so much further away versus here, you don't see any of the roof. You don't see any of that detail. And the same is kind of true kind of all around. And it's not even so much that I was higher. I was a little higher because the slope was kind of up. Like it was kind of uphill slope down over a little rise. But your lens is going to have an impact. And so if you're looking at a lens for landscape photography, a wide angle lens is probably what you're going to be, or a wider angle lens is what you're going to be interested in using, versus if you're looking at a portrait lens, you're going to want something with some zoom to it, some focal length to it, 80 millimeter or 85 millimeter. So that also does play a role in the emotion of your photo. Also, color obviously plays a role in the emotion of your photo. This picture is of, I don't know if I was privileged to take this picture, although it did mean something to me. But this is a picture of my sister-in-law and her family after they lost their child. And obviously, there are times where no color is most appropriate, right? But paying attention to the color that's in your image. Do you want a cool color? I did not take this picture, but it is very cold. You instantly know it's cold. It feels cold. You can almost shiver simply looking at the image, right? Or maybe you want some vibrant color, and this is an HDR image, which means that we took the highlights and the shadows of images and kind of put them all together in one. So this is a very processed image, but you can kind of tell that because we have a very colorful image overall. We have bright blues. We still have good color on the house and the warmer tones of the gazebo or pergola or whatever it's called. Maybe you want some warmer color. This was another drone image that I took, which a little bit of editing does also help. This being not the original sky, obviously everything else, the sun flare was natural, and it was a similar situation, but you will find that with your camera, especially a drone doesn't have the most amazing camera, did not have the capability to capture most of the sky was mostly blown out. So with a little bit of editing, we can bring in a little more detail, add a new sky, and we get possibly my favorite picture that I've ever taken. I don't know. So that's mostly what I have. I'm going to spend a little more time talking about just a couple more images and talking about the emotions that they show, or the elements that we're trying to curate, what's important to show in the image. So here, this is obviously taken for the building manufacturer. The whole point is to sell the building, right? But to do quality craftsmanship justice, we need a quality photo, some photo that we've put some time into to when we took it, making sure the elements were carefully put together, and then as we edit it, selling it as much as we can. Here was a unique water feature that they had done for I don't know if it was a junkyard or it was a car. It was a car fixer up a place, whatever, mechanic at a body shop. Anyway, they had this in there. They had this water feature. We were taking pictures of different water features. If we take a picture, obviously, maybe you tell me, what was the key factor in deciding how to take this picture? What was I paying most attention to? Of the exposure triangle. My aperture, my ISO, or my shutter speed, right? Yeah, shutter speed. Because if I take a photo with a high shutter speed, this water is going to look fairly blocked. Whereas if we add a little bit of shutter speed, we can get some nice smooth water. Here again, same thing. Adding a little bit of time to my shutter speed, that gets confusing because it depends how you add. Either way, it can be doing the opposite. adding a little bit of time to the shutter speed, and we can spread these out, get some nice, nice emotion to your water shot. So if you've taken any pictures of waterfalls, you know exactly what this is like. If you take it with a fast shutter speed, you're not going to get the emotion of the waterfall that you want. One other picture, yep. Oftentimes, whenever I take photos and edit them, this is a little bit more on the editing process, but if you pay attention to the composition of this image, the composition is fairly standard, but as you edit the image, if you use the hue saturation to edit the colors of an image, you can end up with a much more impactful. I should have brought the original image of this along, because the original image was great. It was fine. We're obviously trying to sell more or showcase the garages that this company builds, but I was a little bit limited by the house being here and the line of trees here for what I had. I felt like it worked fairly well, but in the editing process, trying to align the greens and yellows to make them complement each other, oftentimes you can kind of bring the colors together. So if you were to count the colors in this image, it's what, three? Maybe even two, if you consider that yellows and greens are pretty close together. There's maybe another color or two in this bush, but pretty minimal. So bringing kind of the colors together, and this I think is not the final image, because on the final image I also corrected the perspective of the building. You can see the perspective is leaning in a little bit, but you can pretty easily adjust that in Photoshop. Trying to align the colors to bring more impact to your imagery as well. Any more questions that you all have? I think I'll open it up for any questions.
Just a comment on what the sister asked about the camera. I agree, especially your lens is one of those critical things. Some people overbuy camera and underbuy lens. But at the same time, the picture that I took that I have sold the most, I took with a little Sony point-and-shoot 3.2 megapixel. I was there at the right time, under the right conditions. That's all it was. I'm just saying it is not... some of the really nice pictures I've taken with simple point-and-shoot cameras, that's all I had. So it's not just that. And Ben was reminding me of this thing where when we compliment the cook for a really good meal, we don't say, wow, what a good meal. You must have a really nice stove and some really excellent pots.
Yeah, often it is about being at the right place at the right time. It's probably one of the things I enjoy about my line of work, is that you get paid to go out and to some extent be at the right place. Sometimes you can help choose the right time, sometimes you can't. But like you said, sometimes it's a matter of things that happen that you, if you're there, great. But I would agree that it's more important to know how to use the equipment that you have than it is, you know, what specific equipment you have. And that's why this morning's talk I kind of focused on understanding how to use the aperture and ISO and shutter speed all together to accomplish the photos that you want. And we talked about it a little bit some more. Because a lot of the emotion that your photo carries is because you either knew how to use it or you didn't know how to use it, what you actually had. Any other comments or questions? Yes?
Kind of to echo that, so I have a friend who has a very small photography business. She does portraits. She does it with her iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, what is the big difference, and clearly there is a big difference between like using a Canon, depending on like, you have more control, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
But like, what is the big difference between like using an iPhone? Clearly I know there is a difference, but is it just that you can use the exposure triangle or like the triangle?
Yeah,
or
so
what would you say if you can use iPhones for photography?
So you can use your iPhone for photography. And in reality, all of these phone manufacturers are chasing down the DSLR, mostly because, as he already pointed out, it's as much to do with being in the right place at the right time as it is having high-end equipment. I would push back a little bit against that, especially if you're doing photography as a business and just relying on your iPhone. It's possible, but... And you can even buy apps that allow you to have control over your shutter speed and aperture and all of that. Maybe to that point is the biggest problem with that is that they're trying to solve a lot of problems with software in that the sensor size on an iPhone, let's be honest, is that's three sensors right there, right? So you already know that the sensor size is pretty small. The sensor size in my Canon, which I didn't bring on camera, is probably yay big, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get, let's just say if you're going to blow that picture up and print it out on a nice, that disc golf picture that I had before, I have that on my wall at home. It's a nice 4x6 aluminum print, right? When you blow an iPhone image up, it's not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
It might work for wallets. But if you're going to do something large and nice for someone, you're going to notice it. It might work. I mean, it might pass. But that would be why I wouldn't, especially considering the fact that I sell my photography services. It seems only right that I offer something that's worth printing as a product. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it did. So you're saying, like, one of the big differences is the sensor size between, like, a DSLR camera and the ability to blow that up versus an iPhone, which has a
Yeah. So, and it's not only about pixels, because my camera is 40 megapixel, which isn't near anything, because with the iPhone, they still pack in lots of pixels. But if it's a small sensor size, the amount of light is still minimal. So whenever you try to blow that up and get a nice quality high print, high quality, good size print out of it, you're still going to see where, and this is what I was saying, they're often trying to fix those problems with software, where they're doing a lot of smoothing and a lot of mathematics behind the scenes, and they're getting really good at it. Let's be honest, even the iPhones, especially with the three lenses, or the Androids with multiple lenses, where they can composite the information together, and they can give you a nice rendered blur depth of field, right? It's all rendered, it's not actual. And you can then see it out, if you look closely, especially on the older ones where they first started doing it, you can often see the halo around the subject where they're doing the depth of blur rendering. So there again, if you know your equipment, am I going to say thou shalt not do it? I personally wouldn't, but you can do whatever you want.
And not all iPhones are equal. You have a 6mm iPhone, a $20 iPhone, a $26 camera, maybe a $100 camera, and that same phone.
But, like I said, it is always with you, and in that instant where you need to grab a picture now, it's there. So, it's a great option. Because I don't carry my 70 to 200 with me everywhere, although I would love to. It was bad enough. I actually had that disc golf picture. I had someone else who was along who was just taking pictures just for the fun of it. They didn't care about disc golf, but they wanted to take pictures, which is the only reason I had it with me, right? Because I wasn't going to carry this 10-pound camera all over the golf course. But if someone else was going to, then I would use it whenever the opportunity arose for the picture.
And pricing, camera pricing. If you don't do a lot of photography, I started out, the first camera I personally owned was a Canon SX 640 or something that had a really good range as far as the optical zoom. I think it's the equivalent to like 1300 or something. It's like 60 times optical zoom, which you have to have pretty good light to be able to zoom that much for a small sensor. I don't remember. It's probably a $600 camera or $700-ish now. I'm not sure exactly. But I took lots of pictures, and I love that camera, especially for nature photography, you know, with birds and things that you can't get close to. Because, you know, you can run it manually, pretty much. And you were a little limited. It didn't have quite as much range and settings. But, you know, I still have lots of some of my favorite pictures that from early on I took with that camera. And eventually it wore out and it wouldn't focus quite right anymore. But, yeah, you don't have to buy real expensive cameras. You know, if you have something that's half decent and, yeah, and you can get your settings right, you can do about anything.
Yeah, along with that thought, that brings a point. If you're enjoying photography, I would highly recommend take some of your favorite photos and print them. mpix.com, there's any number of hundreds of different places. Get a nice 8x10 or bigger image, and that will quickly tell you the flaws in your photography, because whenever you start to see a nice size image, it'll quickly tell you how well you're doing when it comes to framing or even editing. Any noise that starts to show up or any of those things will be magnified as you print a nice high-res photo, which is, yeah, kind of back to that point, which is where your iPhone would quick, that's where you would probably start to notice it sooner than some of the other places. If you're just going to look at it on a small print, you're not going to notice it near as much. Yes?
Question. So when you shoot, say, portraits at your longer focal length, mm-hmm, how do you keep from getting blurred, your picture motion blurred? And how much of that is acceptable trade-off for your nicer composition?
Yeah. So here again, if you have a faster or a wider aperture lens, it's going to help you a lot. Because as soon as your aperture starts to close down with some of your cheaper lenses to f/11, like, you need all the shutter speed you can get, right? So that you can have a properly exposed image. So this is back to the point where a more expensive or higher value lens will do you wonders. Because if you have a nice wide aperture that you can use, then typically it shouldn't be a problem. Alternately, you can just make sure you're locked down on the tripod, use the tripod, and then snap your picture from that, make sure it's locked down good. But if you have a wider aperture lens, you should be able to shoot handheld and be all right. Yeah.
Okay.
I have heard the rule of thumb of, and I told some of you this already, if you're trying to figure out what lens to buy, figure out your budget that you want to spend on photography. 2/3 of it goes to lens, 1/3 of it goes to the body camera, simply because your lens can make a big difference in the photos you can capture, and probably a bigger difference than the camera body itself. Because if you can have a camera, like I mentioned, if you can have a lens with a wider aperture, you're going to be able to capture better in those situations that a cheaper lens is not going to be able to counteract. Like, you're still going to be stuck in the same situation. Whereas if you spend a little more on the lens instead of the body, you might be able to get yourself out of some of those situations. So it's kind of a rule of thumb that I use. All right, well, thank you so much for your participation, and hopefully you learned a little bit of something. I don't feel like an expert, but I do enjoy photography, and I'm privileged to do it for a job, so it is enjoyable. Yard dismissed.